Progtopia Year in Review 2016. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of you out there in the land of Progtopia. My name is Mark Ashby, and I'll be your guide through the wilderness that is populated by the best acts in progressive rock, metal, and electronic music, whether you know them well or they're on the rise. You'll hear song excerpts and exclusive interviews on your journey, and hopefully when the trip is over, you'll be moved to support these artists who create the music we all love. The show is on the web at progtopia.com, or you can follow us on social media at facebook.com/progtopia, or at Progtopia on Twitter. And you can always subscribe to and rate the show on iTunes. I hope you enjoy your time here. So let's begin, shall we? Wow, here we are at the close of Progtopia's fifth year, and might I say, I think that even though other events in the world have some thinking that 2016 was fairly awful, as far as this show is concerned, I have to disagree. Not only was it a great year in progressive music, but Progtopia had some of its most well-known artists on the program over the course of these 12 months. We had a planetary premiere, a backstage pass, and we hit our 100th numbered episode, too. Not bad for a year's work. So, as always, we take this final show before turning that calendar over to look back and reflect on the year that was, with short clips from all the interviews, loosely organized by topics discussed in those interviews, and a little bit of music, too. Plus, for the first time on the year-end program, you'll hear who is awarded that coveted prize of Progtopia Album of the Year. I'm sure you can't wait for that. But before we get going, here's a quick listen to all the bands, artists, and singers that were part of the show in 2016, in the order they appeared, although they'll be jumbled when it comes to the recaps. First, the appropriately named, for this show anyway, Ashby. The Barstool Philosophers. Doro Pesch. Gonna keep on my path, though I get to the end. Gonna scream at the darkness, gonna fight to the end. Craig Chiquiso. Dante. When the end I'm saving my faith, and there is nothing to do. I Am the Morning. No one to follow when you're on your own. Redemption. Odd Logic. I am the one you want to know. Ask me anything and I will tell them. The Rube Goldberg Machine. Entertained. Kept controlled and kept contained. Circular. Eric Norland. Tilt.
I'm gonna catch you if I can, gonna tear your world apart.
Earthside. Dream the Electric Sleep. Profusion. Golden bottles are just a dance. Thomas Dolby. Glass Hammer. So we tend to do the best we can. Here within the living of the chances we're rehearsed. The Gift. Marillion. On your knees, peasants, you're living for the new king. You're living for the new king. You're living for the new king. Neil Morse. Raber. Malachi exposed the lie. And finally, Pimina. So one of the topics that comes up from time to time on the program is the geographical location of prog bands, especially if they're in my home country of the USA. It's a fairly big country, in case you hadn't noticed, and unless you're in or near a few select cities, like those mostly in the northeastern part of the country, it can be something of a dead zone for prog here. Or so you might think. Odd Logic, from episode 092, released their album Penny for Your Thoughts this year, and they're based in the far northwest corner of the country, best known in decades past as the birthplace of grunge, so you might not think that prog is anything approaching a big deal up there, but according to the band's guiding force, Sean Thompson, they do okay.
You know, we've had an interesting reaction in the gigs that we've had here. It's not necessarily the easiest thing for club promoters to link us up with other like-minded bands, but so far it's been pretty good. You know, we've come across some pretty cool people. There's a band out of Salt Lake City called Melodramas, which is really cool. They're up here now. We've started to kind of be a brother band with them. Definitely got some prog influences. So we're sort of sifting through best we can, trying to play gigs that match us because, you know, we said at the beginning, I don't know if it was on air or not, but that, you know, progressive people are allowed to be snobbish. And we've kind of taken the approach that, look, if we're going to get a gig with, you know, a screamo band or something that just doesn't match, and we're not interested, you know, we kind of want to build momentum here and not get fruit thrown at us. So we're doing our best to find the like-minded people. And so far, it's been pretty good. I gotta admit, you know, I thought the same thing before I went back out to play live again in the mid 2000 to 2006 or so when I started to get out again. And I've been really surprised with the talent that's up here. I mean, I think it went from the grunge age in the 90s to this pretty talented group of musicians up here. And so I'm not too worried about it. And I, like I said, I think it's a strength. There's not a lot of actual quote-unquote progressive rock bands up here. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll all go really well in this area.
Another area of the country not typically considered prog-friendly is the southeastern region, where our next two bands both hail from. This is the area of country and western music, after all. Glasshammer's Steve Babb and Fred Schendel were on episode 101 talking about their new concept album, Valkyrie. And being from Chattanooga, Tennessee, it was suggested in an article I had read in researching the show that they were in something of a, quote, backwater. But they disagreed, as Babb explained.
I was born here, and Fred ended up here. And we met here, and we're like prog gods, you know, so I'm not sure if it's a prog or not. But coming from where these guys are, when they wrote that article, they had just heard us complain about how far we have to drive or go to get to kind of a prog rock hotspot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, pretty much anywhere other than Jersey, Philly, Baltimore, you know, mm-hmm. the rest of the country is prog backwater, you know, mm-hmm. where the prog fans are spread out everywhere. So, yeah, Tennessee gets a bad rap anyway, because I think most of the world thinks that, you know, it's just all Duck Dynasty or something here. and it kind of is, and we kind of like that. But mm-hmm. we're right between, you know, Neil Morris, Salem Hill.
Adrian Blue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are two from us. Atlanta's just below us. We're kind of in a spot where music is very alive. I mean, it's Tennessee, so it's a musical place.
Slightly to the north of Tennessee is Kentucky, specifically the city of Lexington, which is where episode 098's guests, Dream the Electric Sleep, hails from. Singer and guitarist Matt Page explained that he and his cousin Joey Waters found some common musical interests there when they were young, not necessarily prog-related, and that it didn't come together in full band form for over a decade when their third member, bassist Chris Tackett, started jamming with them.
Yeah, so Lexington's not that big, you know, it's 250,000 people, and, you know, it's in Kentucky, which is 4 million people, so, and it's a big state with a pretty dispersed population. Right. Joey, the drummer, is actually my cousin. We're third cousins, so we've known each other since birth.
Okay.
And it just so happened that I started playing guitar when I was 12, and he started playing drums when he was like 13 or 14. And I think he called me one day randomly. We didn't really hang out, and said, "You want to get together and play?" And I was like, "Sure." You know, we sort of grew up with the 90s, you know, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, which is, you know, a reference back to the 70s of Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and all of that kind of stuff. So that's sort of where we found some common ground, I think. And then much later, obviously, I guess, gosh, if we started playing together when we were, you know, 15 or something like that, Chris came along, you know, 14 years later, basically. It took a long time for Joey and I to find another person. We played with a lot of people, but to find that one other person who really clicked, the way he and I clicked together. So we met Chris, and after the first practice, it was that same feeling of, oh my gosh, this guy's got it. We get it. We've got that high mind. You get together.
Their album, Beneath the Dark Wide Sky, was also released this year. But, of course, not all of our guests were American. We are listened to worldwide, judging from our stats on Podomatic. So let's turn our attention to two other bands who are either based in or have influences from Eastern Europe. Got listeners there, too. Hi, everybody. While Perfusion, from episode 099, is based in Italy, their drummer and longtime member Vladimir Sichinava has roots in Georgia. And as keyboardist Jonathan Caradona explained, that influence comes out quite often in Perfusion's music.
Vladimir made everything, in the sense that he not only contributes to the songwriting, but also... it's 15 years I play with Lado, and other people play with Lado, and when you are with a person, you take from that person everything of his culture, because you become friend, you share moments, important moments, you share a lot of time. And so regarding music, I can say I am lucky. Everybody's lucky in the sense, because it's different in Georgia. It's different from with respect to let's say continental music. Mm-hmm. In the sense that they have a different way to approach the rhythm, the harmony. For instance, it feels you feel so natural when you have an odd timing, you know, 5 mm-hmm. over 4 or 11 over 4. Mm-hmm. You feel it so natural because that patterns are suitable for dancing for them.
In episode 090, we heard from singer Mariana Semkina of I Am the Morning, a critically acclaimed band who, despite being from Russia, are getting noticed around the world. I asked her if she felt being based in Russia held her or the band back from wider exposure, even though they're signed to K-Scope, and if she had considered relocating elsewhere in Europe since she travels often.
Well, that's what I've been thinking about for, like, years now, mm-hmm. to be honest. I mean, I really love Europe. Everywhere I go here is just beautiful, and people are very supportive and sympathetic and very, very nice and lovely. And I would love it very much to move somewhere eventually, but it's not an easy thing when you're in Russia, because I don't have a lot of options of moving out. I only can spend, like, 3 months in a year, or like 3 months and a half a year outside the country. Well, that depends on the visas that I get, because, you know, Russian people need visas anywhere we go.
Sure.
So, yeah, that is kind of one of the dreams of mine, but I'm getting close to it because I'm spending a lot of time in Europe, like in the UK and in Netherlands, but I haven't been able to move here, like, once and for all yet. So off you go into silence, the season of fear, and to what is real, the silence breaks with a crack that I don't want to hear. It's making it real, so off you go, for all I know, you never come back into your empty home. So say goodbye, the shadows mild.
Silent fever, all the words they deliver, not even. Their album, Lighthouse, is also one of the best from the year, if you ask me. Now, no matter what instrument you play or the instrument that you like the most, I think we can all agree that in general, a singer is what defines a band. Most of the time, a group will only have one person handling vocal duties, but for a group like the Barstool Philosophers from the Netherlands, on their late 2015 album Crossing Over, they went the route of the Alan Parsons Project and had multiple singers contributing, including their eventual choice for permanent frontman, Peter Van Asselt. Keyboardist René Kroon talked about the process in episode 086.
Well, they're all familiar people to us. For me, I played in Suncage, and Paul Adrian Villarreal, I really think he's a really great singer. So I asked him for a song, and everybody actually knew people. Marlene, the female singer, I knew her because I recorded her with she had a band, and she recorded some songs at my place, and that's where I knew her from. And Martin Kuipers played with actually almost all the other singers.
Out of this process of recording the album, you did decide on a permanent replacement for vocals, which is Peter. So why did he get the job?
We had a really great click with him, actually with everybody, but we thought he could do things differently and will maybe sound a little bit differently. So that's how it worked, actually.
Another band that uses multiple singers, two, one of each gender, and their permanent members, is Circuline, who appeared in episode 094. One of those singers, Billy Spillane, talked about how the arrangement with his counterpart Natalie Brown came to be out of a cover band that preceded Circuline, and keyboardist Andrew Collier will pick up the story afterward.
That sort of was kind of happenstance as a result of Andy being involved with Down in Gray and Andy meeting Natalie. And the two of them developing a relationship, and Natalie being asked to come and start to sing some backup harmonies when they were playing live as Down in Gray. It just was sort of happenstance the way it all came together like that.
Uh-huh. I think it worked out. Natalie, I mean, it's good to have that.
Yeah, we were doing a bunch of Pink Floyd stuff, and so Natalie came in to sing a bunch of the Wailing Chick parts. When we used to do Brain Damage, you know, we would do the last three tracks from Dark Side of the Moon, and we needed a chick who could come in and do those wailing parts. So it started with that, and then she wound up singing a lot of harmony parts. And then when Billy joined the band, they just sounded so good together. And then the three of us would sing harmonies, and we thought, well, wow, that sounds pretty good together. And so when we decided to become an all-original band, Billy basically said, I won't do it unless Natalie does it.
Codependent, like you said before.
She was kind of drafted. She was kind of, by conscription, she was kind of forced to do it.
A grand display of fortune. The looking
Their album, called Counterpoint, was released this year. Another good one for you to pick up. Collaborations with outside artists also was a recurrent theme among Progtopia guests this year, and in addition to collaborating with singers like LJ Witherspoon for their album A Dream in Static, Earthside, from episode 097, went all the way to Russia to find their collaborators for a couple of tracks, namely the Moscow Studio Symphony Orchestra. Keyboardist Frank Sacramone described that collaboration and what it was like to arrange and rearrange those symphonic parts.
Well, they are a studio orchestra set up for studio work.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like...
Not like playing for the opera.
To know a guy to get it to happen.
Right.
So they, you know, they're basically... a professional unit of independent musicians who come together to record for bands or movies or whatever, whoever hires them.
Yeah.
Their producer was Yuri Sazonov, was you know, a great guy. We emailed a couple, you know, studio orchestras, and he really took a liking to our music. And helped us out. First experience for Jamie writing a full orchestra score, you know, having to present it to a real orchestra for literally the first time.
No pressure.
So, you know, like we were there and it was like, they'd go through and then there'd be a part where it's like, oh, we need to edit the score or something. And then, you know, we'd come back and then, you'd be like, all right, we got to like redo this part. And then, you know, it's like so much to learn and so rewarding of an experience.
There are few bigger names in the annals of progressive rock than Genesis. That's a given. In our Progtopia Planetary premiere show from the 17th of October, Mike Morton, the singer from The Gift, told us about how he came to have two former members of that band, Steve Hackett and Anthony Phillips, guesting on the track The Tallest Tree from The Gift's album Why the Sea is Salt. It all started with a member of the Genesis tribute band Morton fronted until very recently, and she had an inside track.
She just managed to, over time, procure emails for most of them, including Steve Hackett. And I didn't press, but she was the one who, having his email, invited him to come and see us. I eventually sent him an email saying how much I loved his stuff and could we meet for coffee? And I didn't expect much to come of it, but he said yes. And so there I was meeting with him. I think it was sort of Easterish time last year. About 18 months ago, we had a coffee for about an hour, and during it, I said, would you be interested in playing on our next album? I didn't know what he'd be playing on, and he said, for sure. Anthony Phillips is a very similar story. We invited him to a charity gig the Book of Genesis did at Charterhouse, and then he again saw The Gift at the same occasion at Resonance, and I ended up, this is quite fun actually, after we'd done our performance, I didn't even know he was in the building. And we played the whole of Awake and Dreaming, and it was very important for me, but I was exhausted because we put all into it. So I went to the washrooms, and there I was up against the urinal, and out of the corner of my eye there was Anthony Phillips next to me. I thought, this is an interesting moment. And anyway, we finished there and we were sort of washing our hands. He said, I really, really enjoyed that your set, far better than that dreadful Genesis tribute you do. He was being very tongue-in-cheek in that very English way. Right. And what it was, just like Steve, much more interested in the original stuff. Mm-hmm. And it went from there. And we're good friends. I see him quite regularly. And again, knowing that he was quite reticent as an individual, didn't ask him about playing on the album until I felt comfortable enough to do so. And so earlier this year, when I got clear which song mattered a lot to me, which is this Tallest Tree thing, I asked both of them separately, and they both said yes.
But now the tallest trees falling, our faces feel the rain as darkness turns to morning. Love is what remains. Now the tallest trees falling, our faces fill with rain, and as darkness turns.
Perhaps the closest collaboration of all comes in the form of one's spouse or significant other, if they also happen to be musically talented. For Eric Norlander, in episode 095, he and his singer-wife, Lana Lane, have worked together on projects for years. So I wanted to know if, in the process of recording the title track for his album Surreal, which she provides vocals for, how they bounce ideas off each other and the general give and take they go through.
You know, we're always listening to new things, and even at our advanced age, we still we still discover new things that, yeah, that we think are cool. And you know, whether it's some new pop thing, or someone doing a new version of a jazz standard, or some classical thing, or some heavy metal thing. Who knows? Mm-hmm. We are open to that, and we're playing things to each other constantly. And the other night, for example, we were we're actually just now watching Breaking Bad. We're in the last season of it now, doing our Netflix binge watching. Mm-hmm. And we'll be sitting here on the couch, and there'll be some scene, and one of us will pause it and go, "Oh yeah, that reminds me of this." And then you end up talking about a song, and then of course, you break out the either YouTube or your iPhone library, or you put in a CD, and then suddenly, like, well, weren't we watching Breaking Bad like 2 hours ago? And
switching gears again, two of the more compelling stories on the program this year came from artists who had something valuable taken from them. In one case, it came back, at least in part, but for ex-Jefferson Starship guitarist Craig Chiquiso, he's at the moment still attempting to have a guitar returned to him that was stolen during the infamous Lorelei concert riot in the 70s, but that was recently located in California thanks to an intrepid collector who contacted him out of the blue. This is from episode 088.
And so he said he had this black guitar that I played in the Star Wars Christmas special, and he wanted to know if it was my guitar and if the serial number, because of the serial numbers. And I said, well, I don't have serial numbers. And he said, well, I have it because it's the guitar that was at Lorelei. And I went, wait a minute. I go, that guitar was destroyed. The one I played in the Star Wars Christmas special isn't that one. I said, you have the one from Lorelei. And I said, by the way, you can keep it. But if you have that serial number from a guitar that was destroyed in Lorelei, how do you know? I mean, do you have a list? He goes, yeah, I have a list of serial numbers in a magazine that was published in the late 70s in German. And he was able to decipher it in German that here were the serial numbers of our guitars. And I said, well, do you have, are my Les Pauls on there? And he goes, yes. And I said, great. So now I can start looking for my Les Pauls. And he went, no, I actually know where one of them is. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm floored that this guy is calling me out of the blue because of Star Wars and ancient astronauts and aliens, that he's found this guitar from a riot in Germany and he knows where it is. Mm-hmm. So apparently someone had bought it not knowing it was stolen and had this gorgeous 59 Sunburst Les Paul that they inherited. I think the father-in-law, from what I heard, he inherited this money to get his dream guitar or something like that. So he picked this beautiful 59 Sunburst, not knowing it was stolen, and has it in a safe and is basically as an investment, you know. And the first thing he said is he wanted to give it back. For the last year or so, we've been trying to help him. You know, he wants to get his investment back. So I said, well, it's stolen property, but maybe your insurance can pay for it, or the guy you bought it from. So I've been working with everybody to try to make that happen. And during the course of that, decided now he doesn't want to give it back. And I don't know why he would suddenly decide not to want to give it back, but that being the case, literally the case, he has to go to court. Yeah. You know?
An instrument is one thing, but what if you have your whole career taken from you and you don't know why until years later? That's what happened to Steve Stevens, keyboardist for the band Rayburn, profiled in episode 103. Way back in the early 70s, he and his partner signed a recording contract and were ready to go, but nothing ever came of it. The reason why is kind of shocking.
We came back home and we'd signed the contract. It was fairly standard. It was not much for us and a lot for them,
right.
But we were young and full of beans and ready to go, and never heard from them again. And about 10, 12 years later, after a lot had happened, my father just admitted to me one night that he had bought the contract. Unbeknownst to me and surreptitiously. And the reason for it was I was always slated to be the heir apparent in my family business, my family's business. And he didn't want me to be in the rock and roll world. And that's why he did it. And sure enough, not too long after we came back to Little Rock after signing this contract and we couldn't get the mega record folks on the phone, we played a while longer, but Jimmy got sick. He died of spinal cancer. And I just gave up on music. I just said, well, I'll go back to school and get my degree and go into the business world. And so my father got what he wanted, and I thought my music days were pretty much over. You taught me to defy. I won't be late, late for the morning train. I won't be late, late for the morning train. Luckily, he and his late father eventually reconciled. And now Rayburn's album, The Living End, is out there for all to enjoy, nearly 50 years after the band's initial formation. So, what about health issues? Lots of celebrities left us in 2016, which we don't need to be reminded of. And while that didn't happen with either of the bands I'm about to discuss here, this year at least, I did ask guitarist Nick Van Dyke of Redemption in episode 091 about the cancer diagnosis he received several years ago and how he coped with that despite a grim prognosis.
I had a minor pain in my shoulder that I thought was turning 40, and I thought, God, I'm going to have to go see a chiropractor who I normally don't think are necessarily the highest rung on the medical ladder, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I was prepared to do it, and meanwhile I'm on a drug for cholesterol, which is they have to monitor your blood to check your liver,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Make sure the cholesterol medicine.
Again, I'm there with you.
All right, so I'm on Lipitor or a generic derivative thereof,
yeah.
And I don't like having, oddly enough, don't like having my blood drawn. So I'd been putting off the need to go in and get my blood. blood checked, and my doctor finally called up after a year and said, you got to man up and get a blood test or I'm not renewing your subscription. So I went in and got a physical, and he called me back 2 days later. He's like, this, you know, I want to run this test again. I'm like, okay. He called me back 2 days after that, and he said, I want you to go see a hematologist because there's something weird going on in your blood. And I'm like, okay, that sounds strange. I went to the hematologist, and 3 days after telling me I had nothing to worry about, called back after he analyzed my bone marrow and said I had 3 years to live. So it was a pretty jarring series of events. To go from really, you know, I didn't feel bad other than that pain in my shoulder, which turned out to be a tumor in my bone marrow. Uh-huh. And that was that.
Nick's doing much better now, as you can witness through the release of Redemption's album, The Art of Loss, this year. But sadly, sometimes cancer does claim a victim, which is what happened a few years ago with German band Dante, when they lost founding member Markus Berger to cancer. But as keyboardist Markus Michael explained in episode 089 in promoting Dante's album When We Were Beautiful, the group never really considered hanging it up after Berger was gone.
We did not have the thought of quitting, but this decision really has two sides. You know, on one side, obviously, the whole band does mean a lot to us, and obviously did mean a lot to us back then. And the other, and actually more, maybe more important thing is that Markus repeatedly stated that if he's not gonna survive. He doesn't want us to, you know, like quit the band. And so basically these were the two sides. We were wanted to continue and Markus wanted us to continue. So we really did not think of quitting. Having said that, it really wasn't too sure if we emotionally we were able to, would be able to you know, like carry on without him. I mean, he's been there from day one, basically. So it wasn't so much about the music. I mean, even in the back then, I was basically the one directing the music. I was really presenting all the demos, and in a second step, you know, Markus came in and we really put these demos into complete songs. So I was very confident that musically I could handle that, but the emotional side, if you really can carry on without him and still, you know, have the whole thing named Dante and not something different.
While we had, as I said, some fairly big names on the show this year, part of Progtopia's mission is to shine the light on artists who could become those bigger names if only they had more ears listening to them. While we do what little we can here, sometimes that assistance comes in the form of backing from a label, even in this day and age. In episode 093, Jordan Brown of the Rube Goldberg Machine described the timeline for the band signing to Bad Elephant Music in the UK for the release of their album Fragile Times.
Once we recorded the album, we said, well, I think we have something really good. Let's not just waste it, because, you know, in this day and age, there is so much background noise on the internet that even if you make an outstanding album, it's just a drop in the ocean. So we said, well, let's wait for the right occasion to come along. Let's look for it. But because we're all so busy making music for other people, we kept on saying, well, maybe next month, maybe in 3 months. Let's see what happens. And then one day I was listening to Bad Elephant's podcast, and David was playing his music, and then at the end he played In Symmetry, and he said, well, this is from a band called the Rube Goldberg Machine. They're not on my label. I wish they were. and I just said, well, I think that can be arranged.
Then there's the 21st century way to potential fame, getting on a television talent show, which, believe it or not, is one of the ways that the German band that bears my last name, Ashby, got some attention. Their singer, Sabina Moser, appeared on that country's version of The Voice, although it wasn't her idea to participate, as she said in episode 085.
My mother told me, hey, Sabina, you've got a casting in April. And I was like, what? No, no way. Yeah, but I decided for myself that it could only be something new, and progress is, I think progress is most of the times a good thing. Mm-hmm. Then I took part in this show in The Voice of Germany, and it was a great time. I've met so many new people and so many great singers, and I've got... I had so much fun. I wanted to make an appearance in Voice of Germany just to show everybody, hey, guys, I've got a band, listen to that and not to the show. you know, when you go to The Voice, they make you a fan page. They do it for you if you are a contestant and you've got a Facebook page. And I told them not to do a page for me because I already got the one from Ashby, and everyone who wants to like me has to like Ashby. Like this, it was really interesting. I got less likes than others because the pop listeners wouldn't like this.
Right.
And that's okay because you've got enough listeners, like people who listen to Puck and still watch the show.
You can get their album, Fragmental, wherever you normally buy your music from. Now, music, and art in general, really, is often used as an expression of the maker's beliefs, spiritual, political, what have you. But whether they like it or not, sometimes the real world's beliefs and geopolitics, that all interferes with what a band wants to do. I talked with the half-English, half-Scottish band Tilt for episode 096, just after the UK Brexit vote. And I wondered what the UK's leaving the European Union might mean for them. Members Paul Humphreys and Dave Stewart weighed in.
It will cause problems. I mean, personally, I wanted to remain purely because of being a musician. It's like it will be so limiting, I think, for musicians to be able to travel and perform. I don't know what Dave's, obviously, because Dave being up in Scotland's, whether they have the referendum then to leave the United Kingdom, I don't
know. There might be an issue coming down to see you guys in England.
Yeah
I know. That's it. We're going to need passports to like cross the border. See ya.
Yeah, it is a real strange thing because it's. I mean, again, I think we were all four of us were all for the Remain. I think from speaking to Steve and PJ, we all wanted the Remain, and especially now that everything's come out with the guys that wanted to leave, they've all now up and jumped shipped.
Yeah.
But it is, it's like Steve, because at the moment, as I say, I'm in and out of Europe every weekend with Albert Hammond. I'm just on a plane and do the stuff. And it kind of is, we were speaking about going, this could be disastrous for the thing. But it's one of these things they said it's going to take 2 years. I'm kind of that thing, when it first got announced, you were like, oh my God, panic.
who knows what's going to happen. I think it's one of these things, you just got to get on with it and ride it out. It's going to be 2 years. I know the whole Scottish thing, they're talking about trying to get this, you know, second referendum, and, you know, that would be fantastic, to be fair. I wanted that to happen the first time round. No offence, Paul. But,
time moves fast. Oh, and I'm living at last. I'm living at last. And I'll feed this old friends aloud tonight. Just understand, and I'll lead this loving dead.
Tilt's Hinterland album was a big hit for me this year, so be sure to check it out if you haven't already. Another band that hasn't shied away in recent years from broadcasting their own feelings about the situation in their own country especially, but also in the world at large, is Marillion, one of my all-time favorite groups that I saw in concert in late October. I was lucky enough to talk with their bassist, Pete Trewavas, before the concert for a Backstage Pass episode. And since their new album, Fear, touches on a lot of political issues that could relate to many parts of the world, I asked why they felt compelled to touch on those topics now.
We don't really want to get political. What we want to get is humanitarian. We want we want to make music. I think it's, you know, we've got to an age where, you know, we've done all these albums and it's, you know, who knows how many albums we've got left in us. And so, you know, if we're going to make albums and we're going to carry on doing what we do and believing in it, we want to start making it count. There was a lot of, I mean, it might sound as though it's politically fueled by what's happening in America as well. It was really about England. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Fear album is about the disenfranchising, the way people just feel like they're not part of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, when I was growing up, people were proud of being English and people were mm-hmm. proud of the fact that their country, our country and your country, you know, fought for something.
Mm-hmm.
And even when countries go to war, it's really about oil and money. It's not really.
It certainly feels that way, yeah.
It, you know, and that's more to do with England than America. But, yeah, I think it affects both in some ways. And also the Brexit thing, it's like, well, people wanted change.
Mm.
People voted. They didn't vote. They weren't really thinking they were voting to leave England, to leave Europe. What mm-hmm. they thought they were doing was giving the politicians a shock that
sure.
they wanted them to do something,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to make everybody feel like they counted rather than just the politicians do what the politicians do. And mm-hmm. they're all feathering their nests and they're all going to go on the circuits doing all of the corporate shit after they've been in office anyway, you know.
The gold stops her. The gold always did. The gold took my life. And uranium and plutonium and ammonium.
As we come toward the last few clips, I'll bring it to a discussion of the permanent relative unpopularity, at least among the masses, of the progressive rock, metal, and electronic music we enjoy so much, and how acceptance and concert attendance has waxed and waned over the years. Prog veteran Neil Morse was on episode 102 of the show to promote his just-released concept album, The Similitude of a Dream. And in talking about his early years trying to make a living creating music, he decided eventually that it didn't matter what the popularity level of prog was. He just knew he wanted to pursue it.
So I was a singer-songwriter in L.A., and I was trying to get a deal as a singer-songwriter. Got very close. Some
deal with RCA once, but everything seemed to fall apart. And so then I got back to kind of to my true love in the early 90s, and I started to write this prog music. I think the idea was, between my brother Alan and myself, was like, well, if we're going to fail, we might as well just go down. If we're going to go down in flames, we might as well go down doing what we love the most.
Sure.
And another thought was like, well, you know, maybe nobody will like this, but at least we'll be the only people doing it. I mean, in 91, I didn't know that there was any prog band still around. Of course, it turned out there was an underground prog scene, but we didn't know anything about that. Anyway, I started writing these pieces of music, and my brother Alan got really into it, and we wound up forming a band, and that band became Spock's Beard. And we put out quite a few records in the 90s and made a bit of a splash. So the irony to me was always that the first success that we began to have was when we stopped trying to be successful, like, at all. When we gave up all interest in commerciality, that was, and still is, actually the greatest commercial success that we've ever had.
How did I get so far gone?
Then there's the metal end of the equation. Doro Pesch has been called the queen of metal, deservedly so, as she has been through all the ups and downs that genre has endured since the 80s without ever wavering in her conviction that metal would come back from the dark years of the mid to late 90s. I had a wonderful talk with her about it in episode 087.
I remember the first time I felt metal coming back was in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I went to the release party of Ronnie James Dio.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Magica album. And the record company guy in America, a very nice guy, Dave was his name, he said, "Doro, do you want to go to the Dio party? You guys know each other, right?" And I said, yeah, we were on tour before. I would love to go. So I went to Dio's record release party, and then we were talking, and Ronnie said, "Oh, Doro, I liked your version a lot of Egypt," because we did Egypt for the Ronnie James Dio tribute album.
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, man, that makes me so happy. I love that song. I love your music." And then he said, "That's cool." So we had a good time. A couple of months later, I did an interview with KNAC, and then our new record was, hopefully, I wasn't sure if it would get released, but it looked pretty good or looked better. It was the Calling the Wild album. And then the lady said, "Hey, you know, what are your touring plans?" And I said, "Man, I don't know, you know, metal is like, you know, slowly coming back, but I'm not sure." And I said, "Well, I would try my own club tour, headliner in little clubs, or maybe opening up for another band." And she said, "Who would be like the favorite band you would open up for?" And I said, "Ronnie James Dio." And she said, no way. You know what? It happens that he will call the radio station in 2 hours. Shall I mention it to him? And I said, "Oh, wow, this would be fantastic." And I said, "Yes, please do." So to make a long story short, after a couple of months, we were together on tour, and it was in 2000. And it was the best tour I've ever done, because the places were sold out, packed. Everybody was so happy that the metal spirit was, you know, getting back.
Another major highlight for me this year was the chance to talk with one of my musical heroes, Thomas Dolby, for episode 100. Dolby might not fit everyone's definition of progressive, but he fits mine. And I think it can certainly be defended, and I will defend it, if you consider it from the perspective of him being one who defies genres and indeed thumbs his nose at conventional labels. In discussing his new memoir, The Speed of Sound, he told me about this hybrid quality to his art.
People, they want to label you with a single genre. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a little bit sort of Renaissance and I can do all these different styles, makes me hard to label, because there isn't a genre label that directly refers to somebody like me.
Definitely.
And so I think that is a bit of an issue. And in fact, I think that in certain ways there is a suspicion, certainly in the UK, there's a suspicion attached to somebody that can so freely jump around between styles. So in the UK, in fact, in the music press, in the media, they would much prefer it if there was a certain indigenous authenticity to their music. And so when you get a band like, let's say, the Smiths, then they were treated like they grew out of the Manchester Projects, and they were, or Joy Division, you know, they were a natural outgrowth from the British environment. Mm-hmm. And that somebody like Morrissey, you know, would wake up in the morning before his tea was even steeped, he would have jotted off a couple of songs. Mm-hmm. And that when he walked on stage, he was wearing the same clothes that he would wear at home. That's sort of what's preferred in the UK. So they were always very suspicious of me because I appeared to be able to jump around stylistically.
A blur among the bodies in the stroll. I saw Yelena spinning like a globe. She took my hand and led me on the floor, floor, floor.
So finally, as I promised at the start of the show, I did say you would hear about which release would be chosen as the show's album of the year. So to recap, winners from the past 3 years, in case you didn't know or remember, were Beth Out of Hell by The Murder of My Sweet last year, Esoteric Symbolism by Terramaze 2 years ago, and Dimensionaut by Sound of Contact in 2013. But since I happened to speak with Australian quartet Hemina in episode 104, well, maybe you can guess what's coming in this clip that wasn't part of that show and that I'm airing here for the first time. Check it out. You're probably wondering why I gathered you all here today. Well, what it is, awesome. You know how they compile these like year-end lists of top this and favorite that and everything. And you guys came really close there a couple years ago to being my top album of 2014, and you lost out to Terramaze. That came up in the interview that we just did.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's really sad. So to make up for it, and also because you guys have really put out a wonderful album this time, I would like to bestow upon Hemina Progtopia's top album of 2016, To Venus by Hemina.
Yeah!
Am I forgiven?
You're forgiven, Brian.
All right. So how do you feel? Now you're, you know, tops of a very mediocre podcast. I mean,
hey, I'm very happy. Thank you.
It was good, man.
I'd like to thank God. I'd like to thank Donald Trump. I'd like to thank my favorite Prague Squad interviewer, Cliff Pearson. or is it Jason Spencer? I can't remember.
Your blood.
So congrats again to Hamina on the well-deserved honor, whatever it might mean to them, although I hope it's something. And while I certainly encourage you to get a copy of Venus and all their other music, however you'd like to receive it, Bandcamp, I also hope you'll support every single one of these bands and artists that have appeared on the show this year. They are kind enough to take the time to appear, and I always hope that the listeners join me in giving back to them through album sales, concert attendance, even Facebook likes or Twitter follows, all of it. Then they and others like them can keep doing what they do, and we can keep listening to it. It's hard out there, even for established acts these days, and they really do deserve our backing. So go do it. Now. I'm not kidding. And please, while you're at it, throw a like or a follow to Progtopia on Facebook and Twitter, and visit our webpage, progtopia.com, to hear all the full episodes from this year, as well as all past episodes, stretching back to February 2012. I always pledge at the end of the final show of the year to bring you even bigger and better things in the year to come, and while I hope I've delivered on that promise in 2016, I'm even more confident that it will continue in 2017 for our sixth year of existence. I really do thank you so much for being a part of it, and also one more thank you to all the bands and artists who are on the program this year. If you're listening to the show, you make it all happen, and I really couldn't do it without you. We'll see you next year in a land called Progtopia.